This is WILL 580 and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, May 15, 2011, here on WILL AM 580. Wars, massive unemployment, growing inequality. These are the stuff of our times, and to discuss these matters, we have with us someone who is very alert to the issues of our times, but also has been involved politically as a leading intellectual for the past five decades. Today, we're going to be talking about American politics with Francis Fox Piven for the full hour on Media Matters. We hope you'll join us. But first, before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Media critics and women's groups were troubled and angered by a Brooklyn-based Hasidic newspaper this week. The paper digitally removed Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Audrey Thomason of the National Security Council from the iconic photograph of President Obama and staff gathered in the Situation Room during the operation that killed Osama bin Laden. The paper apologized but said its policy is not to publish photographs of women on religious grounds. How women and girls are portrayed in the media has long been a concern, one where no matter how much progress is made, say women in top leadership roles in government, there is always more to do. Independent Television Service, a public media network that funds documentary films, is working on a new initiative to spotlight women and girls as leaders across the world. Called Women and Girls Lead, the program plans to promote 50 documentaries over a three-year span, showcasing women and girls fighting for social justice and equal rights. Tamara Gold, Vice President of ITVS International.
There is a tipping point right now in the public consciousness about the role that women can, will, and must play in conflict resolution, in global gender equity, in economic development, in health.
ITVS is hoping to extend and deepen the life of each film by sharing the content over many different media, from TV to radio to the internet, and from smartphones to video games. They've also teamed up with international and domestic NGOs and other public media partners to help drive a national dialogue about the issues raised in each film.
Documentary filmmakers spend years, they mortgage their houses, they take out loans, they go to tremendous lengths to finance their independent productions. The way it used to be, where one broadcast or a few broadcasts was the most you could expect for your film, those days are really over.
The first film of the initiative aired on PBS's Independent Lens this week. Called Bhutto, the film chronicles the life of the first Muslim woman elected to lead an Islamic nation. Gold is hoping films like Bhutto will have a ripple effect across the globe, firmly securing women and girls as leaders and change makers.
We're not looking just for female audiences. What we're saying is that these stories about our community and about our mothers, sisters, wives, daughters, and friends elevate us all.
To find out more, visit ITVS.org.
With the court's permission, both parties would like to continue this for 2 weeks to come to an agreement and to finalize.
Okay, does that satisfy you?
Yes?
Yes. Court proceedings are often as mysterious as the TV dramas where most of us get our only contact with them. But a new project called Open Court, launched in Quincy, Massachusetts last week, hopes to make the wheels of justice a bit more accessible to the public. The court's proceedings are now video streamed, and a Wi-Fi network has been set up for journalists and bloggers to post reports and news stories. Joe Spurr is the director of the Open Court project, funded by the Knight Foundation. He believes the open court system is still an important part of our culture of government transparency.
Courts were put in the center of town for a reason, so justice could be administered in public, but that's not sort of the case anymore. Journalists don't really even have time to go down, never mind the public, unless you have your own case.
Spurr and his colleagues are creating a template for other courts to modernize public access and create new archiving tools. They're working through the many challenges that have emerged, like establishing common sense guidelines to ensure privacy for citizens.
How to continue to allow, for instance, domestic violence victims to come forward, get a restraining order or whatnot, and trying to figure out sticky issues like that, where that's such an important service of the court. But to a significant extent, the public should be aware of that, but we also don't want to scare victims away from being embarrassed or intimidated about, you know, coming forward.
Spurr says that as smartphones and laptops enter the courtrooms across the country, policies and laws will be revamped over the next few years. Spurr hopes the lessons of open court will be used to create good systems that are respectful of individuals and useful to the community.
Before the technology gets to the point where it's very easy, let's try to set up a best-case scenario right now in a safe environment and figure out the policy so we can do this right moving forward. So we're just trying to sort of get the ball rolling, doing common sense stuff that seems useful right now.
To watch Open Court, go to opencourt.us. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest someone I've been wanting to have in the program for a long time, so I'm delighted she's able to join us. Frances Fox Piven is a professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She's one of the most acclaimed scholars in her fields of our times, a winner of the C. Wright Mills Award, a recent president of the American Sociological Association. We could spend the whole hour going through her accolades. She's the author of numerous books that are extraordinarily influential among activists and among scholars, including Poor People's Movements, Regulating the Poor, Why Americans Don't Vote, Why Americans Still Don't Vote. The list goes on and on. Several of those books were co-authored with her late husband, Richard Cloward. It is a great honor for me to welcome Fran Piven to Media Matters. Professor Piven, welcome here.
Oh, and I'm glad to talk to you, Bob. Very nice.
You know, I went through my notes and my through the internet looking at the body of your work or much of it in preparation for the show, and there's so much material to cover. And I'd like to start with a few general questions to take advantage of the fact of the experience you've had as a scholar for now 5 or 6 decades. And the vantage point you bring as someone who is still very much alert to politics is as alert as ever, from what I can see, and who's been engaged with American politics and American letters for now 50 years. If you could just start by giving our listeners your sense of America and how it has changed as a nation, for better or for worse, in, say, the 50 years since the mid-1960s?
Well, I think American politics always changes in the sense we go through waves of democratic upheaval. And in the aftermath of those upheavals, which consist of, you know, powerful social movements from the bottom, I think American the American nation was forged in such an upheaval. We think about the Revolutionary War as a fight with Britain, but it was also a domestic struggle between poor people, laborers, and colonial elites. And in the aftermath of that upheaval, you know, people sort of go back to their normal lives. They win some things. And when the social movements die down, we see a long, slow process of elite aggrandizement. Now, it isn't always, you can't say in the 1790s it was capitalists. It was merchants and landowners, big plantation owners. And they, in a sense, took back some of the gains that had been made during the Revolutionary War, but something like that happened again in the period leading up to the Civil War. It was a period of great struggle, of struggle by abolitionists, black and white. And that struggle did precipitate the secession of the South and Civil War. Once the Civil War was over, the economic elites began to regroup, and a new class of big plantation owners, some of them from the North, emerged in the South, and the industry grew in the North. And it really wasn't until another period of upheaval during at the end of the century that the domination that those groups achieved over national politics was tempered, was rolled back. So it is always a struggle. That's a kind of a slogan, I think, but it is always a struggle. And in the absence of popular struggle, we all lose. But having said that, about the distant past, I think you can see the same pattern. There was movements in the 1930s, movements again, mainly African-Americans in the 1960s, African-Americans and youth. And when those movements subsided, there was a kind of regrouping of American business interests, a kind of reconnoitering. They had, during the in the face of the movements, they made concessions. They had to go along. They, in the 1930s, the most important concessions were government support for the right of workers to strike and to organize unions. And another important concession was the Social Security Act and the basic outlines of the American welfare state. Then came war. And shortly afterwards, the civil rights movement, which spread to the northern cities, and then the anti-war movement, which was mainly students. While those movements were going on, American economic elites and their political allies could not do very much. I recall a letter that Ike Eisenhower, while he was president, wrote to his brother Milton, in which he said, you know, there are these crazies here on the right that think that you can roll back the Social Security Act. You can't roll back the Social Security Act. But, you know, when that was in 1953 or 54. But as time passed and memories of the struggles that led to the Social Security Act, or memories of the struggles that led to the expansion of social programs in the 1960s and the expansion of voting rights in the 1960s, as those struggles subside and American business elites gain self-confidence, they begin to take back what was won. And that was particularly important in the 1970s because the gains of the 30s and the 60s taken together were so large. The counter-revolutionary mobilization that began in the 1970s produced the Washington, D.C. that we know today. Capital of our country that's dominated by lobbyists, a capital that's physically transformed by the fact that the biggest corporations have all opened public relations offices in Washington, D.C. on K Street, and by the fact also that new peak organizations of businessmen and right-wing think tanks have formed and located in Washington. And steadily now, over 40 years, those organizations, those interest groups have been doing their work. And their work has consisted of, importantly, of rolling back what was gained in the 1930s and in the 1960s.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, has been Fran Piven, the professor at the City University of New York's Graduate Center, professor of political science and sociology. She's joining us live today on Media Matters here in WILL AM 580, where the phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or our toll-free line at 1-800-222-9455. Professor Piven, as you've already talked about, your research, you've been one of the leaders probably in researching social movements, poor people's movements. And to sort of connect the dots now to the modern moment, do you sense now that there is anything close to a resurgence of the sort of popular movements, poor people movements, social movements of people outside of power trying to change policy that would map historically to what we saw in the 1960s or before that, the 1930s, or any other eras of social upheaval you've already talked about?
It might well be the beginning of a period of upheaval in which social movements emerge and make a real impact on American public policy and American political culture as well. It's very, very difficult to read the beginnings of a social movement or of a conjury of social movements, because, by the way, you know, there wasn't one social movement in either the 1930s or the 1960s. There were many social movements in the 1930s of unemployed people, poor people, of the aged, of working people. And similarly, in the 1960s, there wasn't one social movement. It wasn't just the civil rights movement, but it was also the movement of women, the movement of young people trying to roll back the military, and eventually the movement of gays and lesbians. So we shouldn't either look for one movement with one agenda, one analysis. That doesn't happen. People's lives are too varied, and they have different issues and different identities. But it's also the case, and this is what I was starting to try to explain, that only in retrospect do movements look like one big wave that begins and grows and grows and grows. When you're in the middle of a movement, it's much more like the sputter of a car that isn't working too well. It starts in one place and then it dies down, and then it begins in another place. And nobody who's in the middle of the movement can read the broad curve, at least not at the time. So, you know, there's a lot of protest occurring. That's certainly the case. Wisconsin, I suppose, is the symbolic center of it, but the protests that occurred in Wisconsin also occurred, similar protests occurred in Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and they are continuing. There are protests against cutbacks in education that are occurring. Some strange and small protests, like the young girls at the Catherine Ferguson School, mm-hmm. who staged a sit-in in that school. Or the bank protests that occurred in the first 10, 12 days of May. There were sit-ins in banks and bank stockholder meetings. And then there on May 12th, the march it was half a dozen marches that descended on Wall Street. Does that add up to a great movement? Not yet, but it may well be the beginnings, the multiple beginnings of a great upheaval. You know, we had better hope so, I think, because these periods of movement, of insurgency, of protest, are periods when we get a lot of innovation in government policy, and there are periods also when in a sense, American governance becomes, from the point of view of the society as a whole, it becomes more logical, more rational, more functional. We did not inaugurate a social insurance programs in this country gradually, one by one, as in learning perhaps from Germany or from England. We did not inaugurate those programs. They were resisted until there was a massive upheaval. But think how much more rational, how much more communal a society is that makes provisions for its aged or its disabled or a mother raising children on her own. That's a rational thing for a society to do, but we did not do it until there were protest movements that in a way forced the government's hand.
You know, Fran Piven, if we don't have, if these protest movements don't amount to much that maybe we're seeing nascent versions of in Wisconsin and around the country, if they do peter out, we'll look back and say, well, they never really got off the ground for whatever reason. Where does, given the political trajectory right now in Washington and at the sort of elite level in this country, where is this country going in the next 5, 10, 15 years? What sort of future are we looking at? If there isn't any sort of change in the sort of political calculus?
Well, as a society and as a nation, I think we will slide. We will go down. We have already lost our unchallenged preeminence in the world. That's okay. Other countries have lost their preeminence. And if you look at a country like Holland, the Netherlands, well, they became a better country when they no longer were an empire. And in the end, they became a quite humane society. So we are losing standing in the world, and our military power no longer carries the threat of our military power no longer carries the same clout that it once did. But that's not a problem. What is a problem is that we're losing the capacity to make decisions that are good for the people of the country and the people of the world. We're losing the capacity to invest in infrastructure or education or health. And we're losing that capacity because of the uncontrolled growth of business influence. Business influence that was at first most marked at the federal level in national policies, which had the consequence of giving more and more of our budget away in the form of subsidies to business, which had this business influence had the consequence of rolling back regulations on finance and on business. It had the consequence of so weakening the National Labor Relations Board as to result in the shrinking of unions. And it had the consequence also, ultimately, of a fiscal crisis, because when the bank crisis occurred as a result of deregulation, what did the banks do? They demanded. They used the threat of a financial meltdown to demand and to get a huge bailout. And it was a bailout with taxpayer money. GM got a bailout. The consequence is that you can see on the national level that there is a fiscal crisis, they keep saying. It's a crisis of it's a manufactured crisis. It's a crisis that was manufactured by the greed of American capital. And now this crisis is making its way down to the state and local level, where it will have the consequence, it's already having the consequence of forcing huge rollbacks in public services, in schools, in other public facilities, cutbacks in public employment. And everybody says, it's inevitable. Nobody can live beyond their means. It's not inevitable. It's a manufactured crisis, the result of how much was taken from government revenues by the biggest economic interests in the country, and how much was taken not only in the form of tax expenditures and subsidies, but how much was taken as a result of their success in rolling back taxes on American corporations.
Our guest, Francis Fox Piven, the professor from City University of New York of Political Science and Sociology, joining us today live in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number here, 217-333-9455. The toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Piven, if we could switch gears to another subject, just briefly, I'm interested in getting your take on, and I don't know if this is an issue you've written much about, but I suspect you've thought a lot about it, which is research universities, the state of higher education in the United States, the role of intellectuals. The University of Illinois, of course, is the hometown of WILL, so a lot of our listeners are affiliated with the university. And the fiscal crisis that you've just been talking about affects public universities in an extraordinary manner. And this combines with long-term tendencies towards commercialization and corporate involvement with research and sort of a economic calculus being applied to higher education. Is this something you've experienced, is this an important phenomenon which you're concerned about? Is it having an effect on the ability of scholarship to do good work?
Well, it's an important phenomenon. Whatever happens in universities has got to be very important, not only because of the role universities play in the economic and the intellectual and cultural life of the country, and in producing highly trained people, but because universities are so big. Universities are now massive institutions in American society. There are more people in universities than there are in the manufacturing sector. Universities are where people are employed, people go to school, and they're very important. We should care a lot about them. Now, I do think that the universities, especially beginning with the public universities, are under enormous pressure now because of the crisis in state budgets. Now, those of public universities no longer, in fact, get a majority of their budget from the public sector at all. They're actually private universities with some public money. But still, they do depend to an extent on public budgets, state budgets, and those state budgets are now being cut back. But, there's another aspect to what's happening in the universities that I think that we need to keep in mind, and that is that the universities have, in the decades since the 1960s, 1970s, the universities have been enormously important cultural and political institutions. They have been the freest institutions, I think, in the United States. The organized right has worried very hard about how to take over American institutional life, not just take over the government in Washington, D.C. Think, for example, of the way in which the right-wing Christian churches assaulted, really, the mainstream, mainline Protestant churches, which had played an important role in the civil rights movement and in the anti-war movement. Well, those mainline Protestant churches, and the Catholic Church to some extent, too, were intimidated by the campaign of the hard right Christian churches, and intimidated also by the fact that they lost so many of their parishioners to those churches. But at the same time that this was happening, the right also wanted to take over the universities. Not long ago, I gave a talk to my union, the Professional Staff Congress on Academic Freedom. And in that connection, I read a memo that was written by Lewis Powell, the Supreme Court Justice.
Yes, in fact, that memo came up on this show just a couple weeks ago for observant listeners.
Oh, good. because so then the listeners to the show know that Powell asserted that it was very, very important that the chamber and other business organizations, if they could not reverse the dangerous opposition to the American system that was growing in the universities, then they had to create alternate institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They created think tanks, alternate institutions, and they also began to support right-wing universities. But my point is that, for the most part, the Powell plan to influence the universities from the outside and from the inside, I don't think it materialized. I don't think it succeeded. They made some inroads into the universities, some law schools, some economics departments. They created some sort of free enterprise seminars. But by and large, the universities became, as the right grew in the country as a whole, the universities became centers of liberal and left culture, political culture. And that's another reason that they are important. They have harbored diverse critical ideas and successfully in the main, not always, not every time, but in the main, the universities have been the most creative and critical institutions in American society, I think.
Our guest, Frances Fox Piven from the City University of New York, professor of political science and sociology, author of numerous books, and former president of the American Sociological Association. The phone lines here are open at 333-9455. The toll-free line is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 1, Muhammad, you're on the air with Fran Piven.
Yeah, great. I hope I can stay on there and not be cut off this time, Mr. McChesney.
Well, are you the guy who called, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? And
I have some critical questions. If you're critical thinkers, there's always two sides to the story, and I would hope your listeners would have an opportunity to hear the other one.
Well, if you don't insult people or do name calling, you'll have an opportunity.
Francis Piven, Clower Piven Act, overwhelmed the system. Now, Mr. McChesney, you're net neutrality. Steal the control of the internet from the free market and give it to government for control. Are you both not Marxist communists?
Okay, sir. Let's stop right there, and we'll answer your question. Thank you for calling, Fran Piven. Are you a Marxist communist?
No, I'm not. I'm a radical Democrat. I believe in economic and political democracy. The caller is also. I think he's getting his information on the article that Richard and I wrote published in 1966. I think he's getting his information about that article from Glenn Beck. And maybe he should go back and read the article, because it was not about overwhelming the system. It was about reforming the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program.
I think that the call does represent, too, the fact, Fran Piven, that you've gotten a lot of attention. If we had you as a guest on this program a year ago, we wouldn't have gotten that call, or any time in your career, probably, we would have gotten a call like that. But this is due to the fact that in the past, I don't know, what has it been, 6 months, roughly?
No, it's 2 years.
2 years? Okay. I have confessed I'm not a Glenn Beck watcher that much. But
well,
I know.
Either.
But you became sort of center stage in Glenn Beck's campaign of against the people he considers dangerous to the United States. You and your late husband made a review for this program. I was astounded. I watched several clips of his program in which he literally said you and your late husband in that one article in The Nation sort of wrote the centerpiece manifesto, which links the entire anti-American progressive movement from Woodrow Wilson to Barack Obama, based on that one piece. And what really was more striking to me than that argument, which I thought was bizarre, was the the hostility expressed towards you by in the online, still available to those who want to see it, by people who go to Glenn Beck's website, The Blaze, and the threats of physical violence to you and to your family.
Yeah, it was. I was surprised by it and nauseated by it, and I think that what Glenn Beck was promoting was a kind of paranoid propaganda, and which is, I think, the insignia of fascist movements. He was telling a story to people who were not, by and large, well-informed. Most of us are not so well-informed. It's too complicated. I was telling a story to explain whatever discontents they may have with American society today, and a lot of those discontents have to do with the fact that we have an African-American president. Telling a story that blamed it on in this case, two people, who 45 years ago wrote a little article about reforming welfare. But, you know, there were other stories that he told that, it's hard to understand what's going on in the society. So you point to a particular person and you tell a story which phantasmagorically links that person to the financial meltdown and the election of Barack Obama. And I don't know if you saw this, but he did have a chalkboard diagram in which he linked us not only to Woodrow Wilson, but the branches from the trunk of the tree were branches which led to SDS, Acorn, George Soros, and the financial meltdown.
Yes, you were blamed for the financial meltdown, too. That's right.
And Barack Obama. Now, you know, there are a lot of people in the United States that think the world is changing in ways that, or their country is changing in ways that leave them unhappy and anxious. How could we have an African-American president? How come large swaths of the country are becoming darker skinned as a result of immigration? They don't like that. And if you can say that it's all because of, you know, a couple of people, you're telling a story that makes it all manageable. Manageable may be with your rifle, but it's very dangerous kind of propaganda. It's a paranoid scapegoating. And, you know, we know some things about propaganda. We know about the intimidation of mainstream media and the increasing corporate influence on the media, the increasing consolidation. But what we don't have as good an analysis of is this sort of social, psychological dimension of propaganda that makes people delusional.
You know, when I was reading this material on the internet today, and again, the threats of violence are just extraordinary. Has there been any, to your knowledge, any police or governmental investigation of these threats? Because if someone were to make those against a public figure, they'd be arrested.
Well, I have talked to the FBI. And as a matter of fact, in the last 2 weeks, I got a couple of such threats on my email, not posted on a blog, but they came directly to my email address, and I forwarded them to the FBI agent who I had talked to. I have reported it to the state police. It's been reported to the Manhattan District Attorney. I don't know what they're doing. I think that there probably could be a case, but, you know, I think there are probably a lot of people who are getting death threats, not just me.
I got a feeling none that I know of, at least, are getting the ones I've seen online, but maybe they are. I hope not for their sake, because I think what you're getting is extraordinary. I am our guest again, Fran Piven from City University of New York. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. And I think, Fran Piven, when those first attacks came from Beck, than I first heard about them, and I think when other people did, including people who aren't necessarily on the political left or political progressives, it was somewhat incongruous because your work has been acclaimed for your commitment to establishing credible electoral democracy with one person, one vote, hardly trying to undermine the system. If anything, the accusation that could be made of you is you're trying to make the system actually work well.
Yeah, I think so. That's what I said. I said I'm a radical Democrat, that I believe in both expanding and in actually implementing the economic and political rights of people who are excluded right now, and poor people in particular. The American electoral system has never fully enfranchised the people that that in a sense it claims to enfranchise. Or put it more clearly, the formal right to vote has always been much more broadly extended than the actual right to vote. In the United States, we have a multi-tiered, arcane system of election administration and voter registration administration, which has effectively made it extremely difficult for the lower swaths of the population to vote.
Can you, off the top of your head, give some sort of statistics to amplify that point? Because it's a point I think that's lost on a lot of Americans, which is that voting is done far more commonly the further one goes up the income or wealth scale, and the poorer people are, the much less likely they are to vote. Are there numbers to back that up?
Yeah, the above the median income, the voting rate is about twice as high as it is below the median income. And it hasn't changed very much. It changed some with the Voting Rights Act. That was a very successful reform. Largely, I think, because the architects of that legislation, as a result of their experience in the South, paid such close attention to the administration of the reform, how it would be implemented, and and the monitoring of that implementation. But, you know, most of the time, the implementation of the right to vote, the very defective right to vote, is left to local election officials who often have partisan interests in not implementing the right broadly, and who, even if they don't have partisan interests, there's a lot of incompetence in what is a very arcane, multi-layered election system. Everybody has the amount of election law that exists in this country is unbelievable. But there has been a big change there's a change afoot right now, but in the election system that isn't getting, I think, sufficient attention. There was a modest liberalization of voter registration in the 80s and 90s.
And to which, I know you're modest about this, but to which I think your work gets some of the credit. I think you and your late husband, Richard Cloward, are regarded as being some of the key players in making voter, for example, being able to register at state agencies to vote far more easier to do.
Yes, we worked very hard on that for a very long time.
Part of your Marxist-Communist plan.
That's right. We worked on it from 1983 to 1997. The law was passed in 1993, the National Voter Registration Act, and we spent the next 4 years in trying to get it implemented. It's been very unevenly implemented. And every year there are moves in the Congress to try to roll back the National Voter Registration Act. Nobody's paying attention. It's just part of election administration. Who's interested in that? Well, it turns out the Congress people are very interested in it, and they're mostly interested in getting rid of that legislation. And in the last few years, I think 32 states have seen legislation introduced in the state houses to require photo IDs at either at voter registration or when people go to vote. And the reason for that is it really is so transparent. If you know anything about the actual small steps of registering and voting, the reason is that many more poor people don't have photo IDs than the population as a whole. So such a requirement has the effect of disproportionately disenfranchising poor people, and in close elections, that can be very defining. That can really carry an election.
Now, Professor Piven, I've heard the argument that comes from the proponents of these photo ID measures is that there's just been an epidemic of voter fraud among people who don't have photo IDs that is just really destroying our electoral system. Is there some evidence to back that up?
None. Absolutely none. The cases of voter fraud. Now, I would not say that there is no election fraud, but election fraud is conducted by election officials and by party operatives. Yes, there's election fraud in the United States, but voter fraud is fraud committed by the individual voter. And as my colleague Lorraine Minniti has said, she has written a book called The Myth of Voter Fraud. The entire book is devoted to examining with scrupulous effort, examining all the cases of voter fraud that have been identified by law enforcement agencies. There is none. There really is none. It's an idea. It's a kind of boogeyman that is invoked by people who want to limit the right to vote.
Our guest, Frances Fox Piven from City University of New York, former president of the American Sociological Association. It's a pleasure to have her here on Media Matters. We've got a couple callers who've been waiting patiently. Let's get to the phone lines now. Line 4, Peoria, you're on the air with Professor Piven.
Yeah, I'll go back to a discussion that at the first of the hour and just make a comment, because I remember when the debate about and the discussion of single-payer health care system in the United States was on was still viable and being discussed. And I remember a Bill Moyers show where people said, "Well, what about?" Somebody said, "Well, if there's a single payer, what about the health insurance companies?" And I can't remember who was on, but it might have been Wendell Potter, and he's, you know, whoever it was who were saying, "Well, they've had a good run, you know, and that's and they haven't served the people, and it's time to do something different." And I just read recently where it came, you know, and then single payer became a dead issue. And I read recently where the health insurance companies just scored record profits. And it made me think of your comment about the about social movements. And
yeah,
okay.
I agree.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Anything else you want to add to that, Professor Piven?
No, well, we didn't really have a movement, a protest movement. You know, I try to define movements, or political movements, protest movements, carefully, because we have a tendency to call every idea that takes hold and spreads, to call everything a social movement. I mean, the American Civil Liberties Union is not a social movement. It's an organization. And I don't think we had the kind of massive upheaval, the defiance, the investment and commitment that big social movements generate over the health care plan. And maybe that's what we need to get a decent health care system, because it will be opposed by the huge pharmaceutical and health insurance companies.
Our guest, Fran Piven, let's go back to the phone lines now to line 1, Charleston. You're on the air with Professor Frances Fox Piven.
Hi. You know, I want to go back to what we were talking about, voter fraud versus election fraud. And I'm a very, you know, active and passionate Democrat, but I still go back to the two elections where Bush was installed, not necessarily elected. And it just seems like not a lot has been talked about with the study that Robert Kennedy Jr. did. I think his article was in Rolling Stone. And then what happened in the next election, where I just can't imagine that there that those two elections of Bush were absolutely on the up and up. But I don't think anybody else remembers it or is even the least bit alarmed that this could absolutely happen again. And the right wing has this surgical way of putting things into people's minds to vilify Acorn and to do all this, and not very many people are up in arms about it. So I'd love your comment, because if there's something we can do at a local level to make sure that, you know, particularly placed people in different voting precincts can, as a true believer, a Christian true believer, sway a few votes here or there, put a few votes in the box, and I'm beginning to make myself crazy, because I think I'm a conspiracy theorist, and I'm not, you know. So I'd love to hear what you have to say. Thank you. And you keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, Fran?
Well, I heard, I can't remember where I heard it, but I heard just in the last few days that the Tea Party was talking about organizing 11 or 12 million voter challengers for the 2012 election. Now, I don't know if your listeners all know exactly what a voter challenger is, but there's a custom, and it's legal in the United States, that permits any citizen to challenge the right of any other citizen to vote. Voter challengers are deployed in elections to intimidate people, especially less well-educated people, poorer people who don't have the self-confidence of some of the rest of us, and also just to hold up the lines, to make the lines move slowly if there's high turnout. High turnout is not good for the right wing. So they're planning this massive deployment of voter challengers on Election Day 2012. I think that it would be good if there was a massive deployment of people committed to watching to make sure that the rights of those who turned out to vote were honored, and they did get to vote. And most important in that, not only do we have to defend people against voter challengers, but very, very important is the use of provisional ballots by state and local election boards. If somebody is doesn't have a photo ID, they might use a provisional ballot. But often when they vote in the wrong precinct, even if the right precinct is just in the same room, they will give the voter a provisional ballot, and the provisional ballots are then frequently not counted. There are all sorts of things to watchdog at the election places of America, because A, they're decentralized, B, they are so politicized, and C, what happens in elections really is important. If Barack Obama and the Democrats lose the election in 2012, the lobbyists who have so much influence in Washington and who have, through their machinations in Washington, created the fiscal crisis in states and localities, those lobbyists will have a free hand.
Fran Piven, our guest in Media Matters. We've only got a few minutes left, Professor Piven. And I was reading an interview you gave, I can't remember when, it was fairly recently. You were talking about when you were just a very, very young girl. I think you were 3 years old, and your father said something to you that you can't trust what you read in the capitalist press. And you said, well, Dad, then why do you read it? And he said, well, you have to read between the lines. And it was an interesting quote, and I was just wondering, given your experience with Beck and your experience with everything that's taken place in our society in the intervening many years since then, do you think your father was right? Do you think that that's a truism, that you can't trust the capitalist press?
Of course it's a truism. But you can't trust any official press. And it's very hard to figure out what is happening in our society and in our government. That's one of the reasons that an understanding of propaganda has become so important, because we're so vulnerable, so susceptible to propaganda. Everything is very complicated. We live in a high-tech society. We live in an intensely bureaucratic society. We can't make the kinds of judgments that we fancy were made in 1776 by the farmers who took up their muskets and went to battle. It's too complicated, and that means that we rely on a press that isn't trustworthy, and we are very much the not the victims exactly. We have to contend with oceans of misinformation, and we haven't figured out how to do that. That's, I think, one of the most biggest challenges for democracy in the contemporary world.
How do you do it personally? I mean, what's your strategy to, you know, not sink under the tide?
Well, I try to read as many different things as I can and maintain a certain level of skepticism, and always keep in mind that, you know, things, as my father said, things are not necessarily the way they appear to be.
Fran Piven, you know, you've worked very hard through your career to make it easier for people to vote, so you could have one person, one vote for the adult population in the United States. And then the question is, well, what is there to vote for? And what is your sense of the, you know, the political options for Americans today, between the Democrats and Republicans? How much of a choice is there? How much allied do you think, how good of a job is the Democratic Party doing of representing the values that you stand for, and you think that they're important?
Well, you know, it's a lot better than the Republican Party. You don't necessarily get to choose what you like the most, but what we have to try to figure out and to try to act on are the conditions under which the Democratic Party does take bold and clear progressive steps. And there are such conditions. It has happened before. The President of the United States has seemed very timid, has seemed to concentrate on placating a right wing that is out of control. But I think it's our job to create the wind at his tail that will make him stronger. But I certainly don't want the Republicans to take the presidency, because I'm dissatisfied with the way the Democrats are handling it.
Fran Piven, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which tends to mean they're trying to get me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday to join us here at Media Matters today.
Pleasure to talk to you, Bob. Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. Good luck with everything. I also want to take this opportunity, if I can, to thank Melissa Trentz for her terrific work as my producer, Kyle Kroha, the engineer, for working the board, and everyone at WILL, this wonderful station that makes this show possible. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back in 167 hours. Until then, everyone have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The forecast for East Central Illinois. Today, occasional showers, high near 51. Tonight, showers likely before 1 a.m. Monday, sunny with a high near 61. In Chicago, it's 43 in light rain, 49 in Bloomington, cloudy and 50 in Danville, 51 in Mattoon, light rain and 51 in Lafayette, light rain and 51 in Terre Haute, 51 in Decatur. It's 50 at Willard and 50 at